President Barack Obama made this point when lecturing the Wesleyan University graduating class of 2008 during his campaign. Our individual salvation depends on collective salvation. But salvation is not government's to give. Indeed, it is not a grant to mankind from mankind. Under the wrong conditions and in the wrong hands, this deviant view is a powerful tool against humanity. The difficulty, if not impossibility, is in containing the soft tyranny so it does not metastasize into a more absolute tyranny, since the diminished and then vanquished civil society is the sole anecdote. American history and traditions make the transformation from civil society to tyranny more complicated for the statist than in Europe and other places, which helps explain its slower pace. As French philosopher Raymond Aron wrote in 1955, "In America there is no sign of either the traditions or the classes which give European ideas their meaning. Aristocracy and the aristocratic way of life were ruthlessly eliminated by the War of Independence. Still, tyranny is a threat that looms over all societies, preventable only by the active vigilance of the people. The statist in America is no less resolute than his European counterpart, but by necessity, he is more cunning. Where the European lurches and leaps, the American steps are measured but steady. In America, the statist understands that his counter-revolution must at least appear gradual and not revolutionary, sometimes even clothed in the flag and patriotism, lest his intentions become too obvious and thus alarming to his skeptics. For the statist, the international community and international organizations serve as useful sources for importing disaffection with the civil society. The statist urges Americans to view themselves through the lenses of those who resent and even hate them. He needs Americans to become less confident, to doubt their institutions, and to accept the status assigned to them by outsiders as isolationists, invaders, occupiers, oppressors, and exploiters. The statist wants Americans to see themselves as backward, foolishly holding to their quaint notions of individual liberty, private property, family, and faith, long diminished or jettisoned in other countries. They need to listen to the voices of condemnation from world capitals and self-appointed global watchdogs hostile to America's superior standard of living. America is said to be out of step and regressive, justifying the surrendering of its sovereignty through treaties and other arrangements that benefit the greater humanity. And it would not hurt if America admitted its past transgressions, made reparations, and accepted its fate as just another aging nation, one among many. The statist must also rely on legions of academics to serve as his missionaries. After a short period of training and observation, academics receive a sinecure, a personal stake in the state via lifetime employment through a system of tenure. The classroom is turned into a propaganda mill rather than a place for education, to shape the beliefs and attitudes of successive generations of malcontents and incubate the quiet revolution against the civil society. Academics help identify the enemies of the state, whom their students learn to distrust or even detest through distortion and repetition. Corporations as polluters, the founding fathers as slave owners, the military as imperialist, etc. Academics claim to challenge authority, but in truth preach authoritarianism through various justifications for and approaches to deconstructing the civil society. They talk of individual rights, but promote collectivism. They talk of enfranchisement and suffrage, but promote judicial and administrative usurpation of republicanism. They talk of workers' rights, but promote the heavy taxation and regulation of labor. Indeed, academics portray utopia as a kind of heaven on earth, but have a high tolerance for the hell of widespread misery. The academics know from history, and better than most, the destructive power of the statist's way. But he believes it is the price humanity must pay to pave the way for utopia, or conversely, he dismisses statist-caused misery as a misapplication of utopian ideals resulting from the poor performance of a particular statist or the nefarious doings of the enemies of the state. The Academy's first cousin is Hollywood, which uses entertainment to besmirch the civil society. Why would actors who are celebrated for freely practicing their profession do the statist's bidding? Writing not just of actors, but all those who pretend to themselves that they are still pushing envelopes and slashing away at bourgeois complacency, University of Tennessee professor Wilford M. McClay observes, "There is profound self-deception at work in people who luxuriate in the fruits of worldly success while disdaining the personal habits and cultural conditions that make such success possible. There is also a strangely hidden compulsion behind the need for such condemnation. Yet somehow even the most incongruous social conventions can take hold for a time. And in our era, the conjunction of a dutiful other-directedness with a dutiful rebelliousness seems by now so entrenched and commonplace as to be almost natural. Its existence would make it very challenging to be truly countercultural, if one is of a mind to be." The late Eric Hoffer, the blue-collar philosopher, provides a compelling answer. "Those who see their lives as spoiled and wasted crave equality and fraternity more than they do freedom. If they clamor for freedom, it is but freedom to establish equality and uniformity. The passion for equality is partly a passion for anonymity, to be one thread of the many which make up a tunic, one thread not distinguishable from the others. No one can then point us out, measure us against others, and expose our inferiority." The actor thirsts for attention, but he lives in the world of make-believe. Once he achieves fame, he wishes for his fame to be used to achieve relevance. Attention and fame would appear to be at odds with anonymity, but the actor finds anonymity in the larger fraternity that is Hollywood, and relevance in its causes, Marxism in the 1940s to global warming today. It is the rare actor who challenges the fraternity. The statist is also assisted by the media, for the media are parasites of the statist, not the government per se, but the statist. They gather information produced by the statist and regurgitate it to the masses. The relationship between the statist and media is symbiotic. The statist protects the media and enhances the media's clout by censoring the speech of others, usually at the insistence of the media. Today, campaign finance laws restrict the amount of resources individuals can use to speak about candidates to their fellow citizens during political contests. And even if the necessary resources are raised, the statist prohibits their use for broadcast communications in the crucial days running up to the election. Hence, the individual must rely inordinately on the media for disseminating information. To the extent there are pockets of independence that challenge the statist, they are treated like tumors that need to be isolated and excised to achieve the purity of the body politic. There are current efforts to resuscitate the so-called fairness doctrine and similar connivances, which would circumscribe the content of speech on talk radio, simply because the forum is generally hostile to the statist. The media decry alternative information outlets on the internet, which do not vet their content through the media's editors. There are now rumblings about regulating the internet, which occurs in places like China. Of course, these neutering strategies are said by the statist to actually promote speech, or responsible speech, thereby disguising his real motives. The media sing like a naysaying Greek chorus, amplifying the mantra for greater statist authority. No matter how robust the economy, they claim the imminent threat of a recession or depression. And when economic hardship exists, often at the hand of the statist, they join the statist in condemning the free market and advocating for more government. No matter the progress in race relations, they insist racism is rampant. In the weeks leading up to the election of President Barack Obama, the media reported repeatedly of the racist citizens who would deny Obama his victory should he lose. No matter the advances of the healthcare system, the media painted as inferior to all others, with anecdotal stories of incompetence and services denied to help promote statist healthcare proposals. Rarely do the media report of the nightmarish systemic failures of the British or Canadian national healthcare experiments. For the most part, the statists' enemies are the media's enemies, as reflected in their hostility to individuality and private property. And the statist and the media have kindred spirits in academia and Hollywood. Their effect is to soften up the population to become receptive to the counter-revolution, or at least lessen resistance to it. Support for the statist ought not be confused with support for the state as is. The statist himself will criticize the state, not for the purpose of reforming it or reducing it, but for changing it in the name of reforming it. The counter-revolution is a constant revolution, since the statist can never rid the individual or state of imperfection and inequality, no matter how hard he tries. He is obsessed with the task nonetheless, and is credited with deep compassion for the effort. The British writer-philosopher C.S. Lewis wrote, "Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It would be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, his cupidity may at some point be satiated. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience." Chapter 3. On Faith and the Founding. Reason cannot by itself explain why there is reason. Science cannot by itself explain why there is science. Man's discovery and application of science are products of reason. Reason and science can explain the existence of matter, but they cannot explain why there is matter. They can explain the existence of the universe, but they cannot explain why there is a universe. They can explain the existence of nature and the law of physics, but they cannot explain why there is nature and the law of physics. They can explain the existence of life, but they cannot explain why there is life. They can explain the existence of consciousness, but they cannot explain why there is consciousness. Science is a critical aspect of human existence, but it cannot address the spiritual nature of man. In this respect, science is a dead end around which the atheist refuses to reason. Reason itself informs man of its own limitations, and in doing so, directs him to the discovery of a force greater than himself, a supernatural force responsible for the origins of not only human existence, but all existence, and which itself has always existed and will always exist. For most, the supernatural reveals itself in the Creator, God. Man seeks God's guidance through faith and prayer. The agnostic accepts the supernatural, but is not so sure of the form of its existence. The deist accepts that God created the universe and man's condition, but left it to man to sort things out through reason. Man is more than a physical creature. As Edmund Burke argued, each individual is created as a unique spiritual being with a soul and a conscience, and is bound to a transcendent moral order established by divine providence and uncovered through observation and experience over the ages. There is but one law for all, namely, that law which governs all law, the law of our Creator, the law of humanity, justice, equity, the law of nature and of nations. This is the natural law that penetrates man's being, and which the Founding Fathers adopted as the principle around which civilized American society would be organized. The Declaration of Independence appeals to the laws of nature and of nature's God. It provides further, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The founders were enlightened men, but not men purely of the age of enlightenment. They were highly educated, well-informed men who excelled at reason and subscribed to science, but worshipped neither. They comprehended them, their strengths as well as weaknesses. The Declaration signers were Congregationalist, Presbyterian, Anglican, Unitarian, and Roman Catholic. At least two founders, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, are widely believed to have been deists. They were men of varying denominations, but united and emphatic in the belief that the Creator was the origin of their existence and the source of their reason. Is it possible that there is no natural law, and man can know moral order and unalienable rights from his own reasoning, unaided by the supernatural or God? There are, of course, those who argue this case, including the atheist and others who attempt to distinguish natural law from divine providence. It is not the view adopted by the founders. This position would, it seems, lead man to arbitrarily create his own morality and rights, or create his own arbitrary morality and rights. Right and wrong, just and unjust, good and bad, would be relative concepts susceptible to circumstantial applications. Moreover, by what justification would life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness be unalienable rights if there is no natural law, since reason alone cannot make them inviolable? What then is natural law if its origin is unknown or rejected? It is nothing more than a human construct. An individual may benefit from the moral order and unalienable rights around which society functions while rejecting their divine origin. But the civil society cannot organize itself that way. It would become unstable and vulnerable to anarchy and tyranny, imperiling all within it, especially the individual. The abandonment of natural law is the adoption of tyranny in one form or another, because there is no humane or benevolent alternative to natural law. Some resist the idea of natural law's relationship to divine providence, for they fear it leads to intolerance or even theocracy. They have that backwards. If man is endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, he is endowed with these rights no matter his religion or whether he has allegiance to any religion. It is natural law, divined by God and discoverable by reason, that prescribes the inalienability of the most fundamental and eternal human rights, rights that are not conferred on man by man, and therefore cannot legitimately be denied to man by man. It is the divine nature of natural law that makes permanent man's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the last sentence of the Declaration, the founders proclaimed, "And for the support of this Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And what of the government's role in religion, or vice versa? Prior to the founding, America was a land settled by people mostly from Europe, and many of them were escaping religious persecution. Consequently, several colonies had distinct religious and denominational characteristics. The Puritans, and later Baptists and Congregationalists, were concentrated in New England, the Quakers in Pennsylvania, the Roman Catholics in Maryland, etc. Several of the colonies were immersed in religion, some more than others, and some were more tolerant of religious diversity than others. Many settlers were drawn to America in search of economic opportunity and congregated in places such as New York, New Jersey, and Georgia. In 1776, when representatives of the colonies signed the Declaration, they did so for the first time as representatives of states and as part of a loose confederation. the designation of the colonies as states did not erase the long histories and traditions of the former colonies. Many continued to promote religion with taxes and land grants. Some states required officials to affirm their allegiance to a particular religion or religious sect by way of an oath, although this practice was dropped a few decades after the founding. And some states continued to discriminate against certain religions. But when they bound themselves to the Declaration's principles, they bound themselves to, among other things, religious liberty. It is little understood that the Declaration was a declaration of political and religious liberty. Despite its different denominations, Christianity was and is America's dominant religion. There is no dispute that Judeo-Christian values and traditions have and do influence America's fundamental laws and policies. However, despite its varying practices and applications in the colonies and the early years of the states, Christianity itself does not preach operational dominance over the body politic or seek justification from it, even while it promotes and defends its teachings through proselytism and activism. In contrasting Christianity to Islam in this respect, Alexis de Tocqueville observed that Muhammad professed to derive from heaven, and he has inserted in the Quran not only a body of religious doctrines, but political maxims, civil and criminal laws, and theories of science. The Gospel, on the contrary, only speaks of the general relations of men to God and to each other, beyond which it inculcates and imposes no point of faith. In Saudi Arabia, the basic law provides that the nation's constitution consists of the Quran and the Sunnah, the actions and sayings of the Prophet as recorded in the Hadith. Supreme religious councils dictate how Islamic law is applied, and to a large extent have veto power over legislation. Islamic law, or Sharia, dictates the most intricate aspects of daily life, from politics and finance to dating and hygiene. There is not, and never has been, support for a national construct of this sort in America. The Constitution's framers wrote the First Amendment to include the words, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Because they believe the establishment of a theocracy would be destructive of both liberty generally and religious liberty in particular. Although the First Amendment, as originally intended and applied, had no effect on the states, its adoption by the Federal Congress and ratification by the states evinced a national consensus that liberty and religious liberty are inseparable, the same national consensus that motivated the Declaration's signers. The founders were remarkably foresighted. It is no accident that Americans are among the most religious and tolerant people in the world. For the statist, however, the Declaration is an impediment to his schemes. The statist cannot abide the existence of natural law and man's discovery of unalienable rights bestowed on all individuals by their Creator. In ideology and practice, the statist believes rights are not a condition of man's existence, but only exist to the extent the statist ratifies them. Furthermore, rights do not belong to all individuals. They are to be rationed by the state, conferred on those whom the statist believes deserving of them, and denied to those whom the statist believes undeserving of them. He acknowledges only that law which he himself sets in place, and which is subject to change or arbitrary application on his say-so. The statist may wrap himself and his deeds in the language of enlightenment, claiming to be the voice of reason, the beholder of knowledge, and the architect of modernity. But recent history has shown him to be unenlightened in his understanding of mankind, moral order, liberty, and equality. Statists have launched bloody revolutions followed by violent periods of terror in France, Russia, Germany, China, and elsewhere, always under the flags of democratic populism, Marxism, National Socialism, and fascism. For the statist, revolution is an ongoing enterprise, for it regularly cleanses society of religious dogma, antiquated traditions, backward customs, and ambitious individuals who differ with or obstruct the statist's plans. The statist calls this many things, including progressive. For the rest, it is tyranny. Is the statist a secularist, or vice versa? The secularist may believe in the supernatural or God and practice a religion, but share the statist's objective of excluding their influence from public life. If such a secularist also shares the statist's egalitarian ends, he is at one with the statist, a religious statist or a secular religionist, if you will, oddly endorsing the Enlightenment without natural law and the statist's promise of heaven on earth. Moreover, the statist may express his politics in the semantics of religion to disarm religious believers and enlist their support to simultaneously advance his secular and ultimately statist agenda. A secularist may also be a statist stripped of God or religion. It is no coincidence that with the rise of New Deal statism, secularism would rise with it. It is also unsurprising that secularism would make its strongest showing not from the ranks of the people's representatives, but from the judiciary. In 1947, in the case Everson v. Board of Education, Associate Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, writing for a 5-4 majority, asserted that no tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. He added, "The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach." Black had been Franklin Roosevelt's first appointee to the Supreme Court. He was a senator from Alabama and a reliable New Deal proponent in the Senate and on the court. He had also been a member of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and was hostile toward the Catholic Church. According to Black's son, "The Ku Klux Klan and Daddy, so far as I could tell, had one thing in common. He suspected the Catholic Church. He used to read all of Paul Blanchard's books exposing the power abuse in the Catholic Church. He thought the Pope and the bishops had too much power and property. He resented the fact that rental property owned by the church was not taxed. He felt they got most of their revenue from the poor and did not return enough of it." Whatever Black's motivations, he orchestrated a wretched betrayal of America's founding and succeeded in rewriting the First Amendment to say what the framers would never have countenanced. Chief Justice William Rehnquist argued in 1985 in the case Wallace v. Jaffrey, "The First Amendment's Establishment Clause did not require government neutrality between religion and irreligion, nor did it prohibit the federal government from providing non-discriminatory aid to religion. There is simply no historical foundation for the proposition that the framers intended to build a wall of separation that was constitutionalized in Everson." Actually, the founders did not require non-discriminatory aid to religion, for it existed at the time of the founding and the Constitution's ratification. They rejected the establishment of a national religion, leaving the states free to make their own decisions. And by the time Everson was decided, the few states that had established churches had long past abolished them. Still, the Everson fiat applied to all levels of government, because the court was not concerned with the establishment of a theocracy, but rather with establishing a secular polity. And the court subsequently extended Everson to mean the exclusion of references to God in certain public settings. A more thorough repudiation of the nation's founding principles, of natural law and God-given unalienable rights, would be difficult to invent. Indeed, as Claremont Institute Senior Fellow and University of Dallas Professor Thomas G. West wrote, "The Supreme Court will allow the theology of the Declaration to be taught in the classroom, as long as it is understood that it belongs to a world that is dead and gone, that it has nothing to do with the world that we live in here and now, that it is not a living faith that holds God to be the source of our rights, the author of the laws of nature, and the protector and supreme judge of America."